Now, I would like to introduce the speaker, Chris. His home group is the Spiritual Awakenings Group in Bernardsville.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Ryan for asking me to come down here. I was down here, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, and I noticed that there was a very cool meeting happening down in Columbus, New Jersey. And I'm really glad to be back. I was actually here a couple of weeks ago, but it was the wrong night. You know, but I'm glad to be back on the right night. I also like the way the meeting starts off. I'm a fan of the first incarnation of How It Works. That gets read at this particular meeting. And I like it because it just seems to hit a little bit harder. There was pressure early on to not try to tell anybody what to do or insist on anything. You know, you might scare the alcoholics away. So instead of saying, you need to say, this is what we did. And a lot of the big book, a lot of the first five chapters or so of the big book was changed to become more palatable, basically, to alcoholics who might not be willing to follow direction. But the way I see it is this is a progressively fatal illness. Over the years that I've been in AA and I've worked with people, I've seen some horrific deaths because of alcoholism, and I'm just a little bit more interested in telling somebody the truth than I am in worrying about hurting their feelings. You know, this is a deadly serious illness, alcoholism, and if we're so worried about, you know, making somebody uncomfortable by, you know, telling them that they might need to do something, you know, if you have cancer, they don't worry about telling you that you need chemo and radiation. You know, they don't worry about hurting your feelings. But for some reason, the alcoholic is just a little touchy, I guess. But I like the first incarnation of How It Works, because it basically lays out what we need to do to recover from alcoholism in a very thumbnail way. I think that's important to know. What happened with me was alcoholism was just beating me up from the very, very beginning. But, you know, when you're young and it's your first couple of years of drinking, you kind of roll with the punches. You know, I was, almost from the beginning, I was crashing cars and getting DUIs and getting in trouble a lot. And, you know, the cops were always trying to get me. And, you know, I started to flunk in school. And, you know, I was not the kind of guy that, you know, parents would be thrilled at that, you know, their daughter was going out with. I was a problem. I don't know that you can get away with some of the stuff anymore that I was getting away with back in the day. But from the very beginning, it was causing a lot of problems. But I was also having a lot of fun. So, okay, I crash a car. Small price to pay, really, for, you know, my ability to go out to a high school party or something and have a good time. You couldn't have pulled me away from alcohol with a Komatsu tractor in my first 10 or 20 years of drinking, because I was absolutely convinced that there was something that alcohol did for me that I needed to get done. You'll hear a lot when you hear people tell their stories about alcoholism. You'll hear them talk about, you know, having a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of social awkwardness, you know, not really feeling like they could step out 100%, you know, without having, you know, some kind of nervousness about it all. And when I started drinking, you know, the fear was gone, the anxiety was gone, the social awkwardness was gone. I was actually more awkward, but I wasn't worrying about it. You know what I mean? Like, I would be scared to death to ask a pretty girl to go out on a date, but get me drunk, you know, and I'd be like demanding that. Yeah, I mean, it was a complete shift in perception for me. I was able to be and do things I was not able to be and do, you know, without alcohol. So alcohol was really, really doing something for me. What I didn't understand, and so often we don't understand, is how much trouble I was in. I saw alcohol as more of a friend than a foe. I saw alcohol more as something that I needed to help me cope with the dilemma of being me, more than I saw it as the chief active ingredient in a progressively fatal illness. I just didn't look at it that way. But over the years, because alcoholism is progressive, I drank more and more and more. It says in the big book, over any considerable period of time, it always gets worse, it doesn't get better. And how that relates to my experience, and so many things in the big book just speak directly to me, experientially, because, when I read the big book, that's a section of me. That's what I was and how I acted and how I thought. And over any considerable period of time, it got worse. Let's say in the 70s, I was drinking a couple of six packs when I went out at night. Well, by the end of the 80s, I was drinking at the very least a quart of hard liquor every single night on a work night. My body over time needed more alcohol to be able to satisfy a craving, a deep craving within me for more alcohol. So it took more alcohol to be able to get rid of that craving. And I don't care who you are, if you're alcoholic or not alcoholic, if you drink a lot of alcohol, the chances are some crazy things are going to happen to you. Some people seem to hold their liquor a little bit better than others, the John Wayne type who can polish off a bottle and you can't even tell he's drunk. His personality doesn't change at all. Well, that wasn't my experience. My personality changed very significantly. It also talks in the book about the real Jekyll and Hyde, when they're describing the alcoholic. It's an interesting book. The book, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that was written by Robert Louis Stevenson, who I've heard historically was an alcoholic. Now, if you go back and you read that book, understanding that it was written by someone who was an alcoholic, it's going to paint a whole different picture of what that book was talking about. The individual in that book would be compelled to drink this stuff and then turn into this monster. And toward the end of my drinking, that's basically what was happening to me. I was incredibly unpredictable. I could be incredibly violent and just bizarrely antisocial, or I could be the friendliest guy. I never knew. Something would set me off, I would just do crazy, crazy things. I would do things like, call up my boss in a drunken blackout and threaten his life. I'm going to kill you, you son of a bitch. I'm going to kill you. And then, because I'm in a blackout, I'd forget about it, and I'd go into work the next morning like, nothing was going on. I guess they didn't have terroristic threat stuff, in the 70s and 80s, or I'd still be in jail. That was just me. I was nuts. The last 5 years, I could not go out to bars and drink anymore because something really bad could happen. I never knew when it would. I just knew that it could. Usually what would happen is bartenders would cut me off because I'm sloppy, pathetically drunk, staggering around. Or I'd fall asleep on the bar, which bartenders hate it when you do that. When you pass out with your head on the bar, makes them look bad. Anyway, I would get cut off, and if I got cut off by some worthless, no account bartender, I would freak out. You're cutting me off. I'm gonna kill you. I mean, I would just go nuts, and they hated that too. And I was about 135 pounds, so it usually didn't work out too good. But I would just freak, like I was being persecuted, and so I couldn't really go out to the bars. It got to the point where it was recognizable to a blind man that I was drinking so much alcohol that I was poisoning myself. I was losing my mind in these blackouts, and I was doing things that I did not want to face when I woke up the next morning. And it got my attention enough for me to decide to do something about it. Now, getting my license back for one of my multiple DUIs, I had to do an outpatient thing at a rehab. That's where you go, you pay your $35 a night or whatever, and you go and you sit in a circle and you listen to, 20 muttonheads talk about what their day was like. It was just absolutely pathetic. I hated it. Shut up, will you? For Christ's sake, just stop talking. I want to talk. And that's the way I was. And so I went to this and I hated it. They would show the Father Martin movies, Kill Me Now. It was just one horrible scene after another, and I would have to interrupted my drinking because it was like from 7 to 9. So instead of being able to start to drink at 5, I had to start to drink at 9. So that means I'd be really not in good shape at work the next morning at 8 o'clock. It screwed up my timing. But I went to this, and I learned something significant. I learned that if you really want to quit and you're really having problems with alcohol, the fourth and the fifth floor of this place is where you go. That's the inpatient. So I went to this outpatient in like 84 or 83 or 84, and by the end of the 80s, alcohol had got my attention to the point where I knew I had to quit, and I made countless vain attempts to quit. This was typical for me. I would come to in the morning, in the clothes I was wearing the night before, reeking of vodka or reeking of bourbon. It's just coming out of my pores. And I'd stagger into the bathroom and, throw water on my face and, I got to get to work. And I'd drive off to work and I would be shattered. It's not even a hangover. What it really is it's alcohol poisoning. It's a hangover is what disco drunks get. You know what I mean? I had alcohol poisoning and I go to work, and so I'm going to work from the whole morning I am swearing to God, and this happened every day for like 5 years. I'm swearing to God, I am never going to drink again. I'm never going to drink again. I don't want to ever feel this bad again. I drink at night, and I drink a whole lot, and it makes me really ill, and I'm shattered the next day, and I feel terrible. I've got my head's ringing, and I'm hearing things, and I'm shaking. Tonight I am not going to go home from work and drink. Tonight is the night that I am not going to drink. Now, if you would have put a lie detector test on me in the morning, and you would ask me, Chris, are you going to drink tonight? I would have said no, because tonight is the night I'm not going to do it. And that lie detector would have said, he's telling the truth, he's not going to drink tonight. Put your money on that. Well, with alcoholism, there's something called the obsession of the mind. It's the strange mental blank spots that precede the first drink. Those subtle forms of insanity prior to picking up a drink. We are at times without mental defense against the next drink. This is the hardest thing in alcoholism to understand. I would guarantee that 50% of the people in AA haven't even a clue what this really means, this powerlessness, because they'll say like, well, today I chose not to drink. Well, how do you do that if you're powerless? If you don't have any power, how do you not drink if you don't have any power? It's a very difficult concept to understand until you've experienced relapse over and over and over again, being absolutely sincere that you want to quit. So this would happen to me. Sometime in the middle of the afternoon, the thought would occur to me that, that decision never ever to drink again that you made this morning? That's kind of a strong decision. That's pretty heavy. We might have to modify that. And I'd modify it on the way home right to the liquor store to buy another quart of vodka. Now, any way you look at this, I am poisoning myself. Any way you look at this, this is insane. by the last 5 years of my drinking, I am not running around keggers, you know, trying to pick up the girls. I'm in a room in my mother's house, like, staring at a TV set, you know, falling out of my chair drunk, you know, so drunk I can't even go to the bathroom to vomit. I'm puking out the window, blah, and filling up the gutters. I mean, just pathetic. Now, any way you look at this, someone that is damaging themselves, seemingly damaging themselves on purpose, is insane. And you know, I was, but you don't get clued into that. Alcoholism is a disease of minimization. It is an illness of minimization. We are always in much more trouble than we think we are with alcoholism. Because we always, in the back of our minds, think we got this thing. You know, or we think, well, you know, I went to 5 meetings this week. I'm good. You know, I put that in the bank. I mean, we have all these crazy things that we think that it's our actions. It's our actions and not the grace of God that's keeping us sober. And one of the things I learned through hard experiences, does it take action on our part to be able to stay sober and recover from alcoholism? Absolutely. But it's not the actions themselves. The actions place me in the sunlight of the Spirit. I am not the sun. You know, without that sun, I am not going to be able to stay sober. So anyway, it's Christmas 1989, real debacle at the Schroeder house, let me tell you. It was just a nightmare. One of those things where you come to and you start to put the pieces together and you're like, no, oh my God. You know, it was just horrible, horrible. And I swore right then and there. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, in the chapter A Vision for You, it says that we get to a jumping off point. If we're lucky, we get to a jumping off point where we cannot imagine life with alcohol anymore because it's killing us, and we can't imagine life without it because we can't cope without it. And that puts us at a jumping off point. And it says many of us wish for the end. And I start to go through this detox between Christmas and New Year's 1989, where it was one of those fish flopping things with the maggots all over me and the animals scraping on the house to get in and the marching band music coming from nowhere. I mean, if anybody has hallucinated through the delirium tremens, they know what I'm talking about. It is not good. It is scary. And, you know, I get through this. And I realized that treatment is not going to work. I'd already done the outpatient, I'd already done the inpatient. I'd been suggested to go to AA. AA was the only place where I actually heard some people that I thought might have been being honest. You know, my initial reaction to AA when I came in was. In the late 80s in my area, I don't know about around here, but in the late 80s in my area, it was kind of like, I don't know how to put the Oprah Winfrey AA kind of stuff where you share your feelings and you talk about your day and, you know, yeah, here's how stupid I was today, ha ha ha, you know. And, you know, so I was sitting in these meetings and I was listening to the one person after another share stuff that I never heard this crap at the bar. You know, you just don't do that kind of stuff at the bar. You know, I'm feeling a little insecure today. You know, you're not going to get served. You know what I mean? If you say something like that. So, you know, I'm hearing this stuff that's making no sense to me. And the first thing I think is, these people can't possibly have had the problem I've had. Because I can in no way imagine sharing this kind of crap. You know what I mean? So when my first exposure to AA was, I thought I was way too bad of a case for something like this to work. You know, because the happy, joyous, happy, free, grateful stuff is not going to work on me. You know, I was trying to kill people last week. you know, this is not going to work. And but I went, you know, because it was suggested. But after this relapse where you know, the jumping off point, I thought, okay, I'm gonna go back to AA. Maybe it'll work. I really didn't think the people were sincere that were talking about that they were alcoholic and they drank, because they, you know, I just didn't relate to them. You know, I did not relate to them. And you know, one of the suggestions is identify, don't compare. That's impossible for like somebody that's new. How are you going to do it? I was trying to find a, you know, someone that partied like me. You know, somebody that was just a crazed, fanatical partier. You know, somebody that would just do mountains of drugs, gallons of hard liquor, you know, go smashing up cars. You know what I mean? Where are they? You know, these people, this guy had an intervention because his boss saw him tipsy. You know, I mean, you know, this isn't, you know. Anyway, I really didn't think it was going to work. I didn't think it was going to work. But I didn't have any other plans. I mean, you know, I knew that on my own, I don't make it very long without deciding, changing my mind, and putting alcohol back in my body or something else. I just knew it from past experiences. So with this willingness born of desperation, I went back to the AA groups. And this time I put like five times the effort into it. I was going to 7 to 12 meetings a week. And I got a sponsor, and I got a home group, and you know, I when somebody asked me to do service, I did service. And this was not out of any sense of virtue. It was out of, you know, I am really scared to go back. I never want to feel or do the things that's happened to me over the past year. So, you know, I'll sit in a church basement and drink bad coffee and talk about gratitude. You know, if that's got some kind of chance of helping me, I'll do it. And I did it. Now, one of the things about alcoholism that's really difficult to understand or fully own is the obsession of the mind. If there's anything that you can do to keep from putting a drink in your body, you're not powerless. You know, it's a really, really hard concept to understand. Do we get power? Does power work in and through us? Yes, it does. But it's a power greater than ourselves. And we have to rightly relate ourselves through spiritual living to be able to access that. Very difficult explaining this to the guy right out of detox who wants to go tour with the dead. You know what I mean? It's just a really difficult concept to get with them. They're powerless. Whoa, man, that's heavy. Anyway, you know, I understand it experientially because, you know, I was there. And, you know, the thing, though, with step one that is also really difficult to understand, and sometimes we have to actually recover from this stuff to understand that it's actually alcoholism, bizarrely enough. And it's after the dash in the first step. It says that our lives had become unmanageable. We need to admit that our lives have become unmanageable. And there's more information in the big book that basically says a requirement for the steps is to be convinced that a life run on our own willpower will be nothing but a failure. It will not be a success. Us driving the boat. That's another thing that is incredibly difficult to convince alcoholics, because we're self will run riot. Self will run riot. Figuring out that self will is the problem is a very, very difficult thing to get through to someone. But after the dash, it talks about our life becoming unmanageable. My first understanding of the unmanageability, it was, I got a lot of it. But it was, I was viewing the external unmanageability. I was viewing the car crashes, the DUIs, the lost families, the getting into, the getting fired, the losing friends, you know, not being able to date anybody with teeth, you know, all of these things. So yeah, my life is unmanageable. I understand that. But that's not really what they're talking about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Heavy drinkers can have those same problems. non-alcoholics, if they drink crap loads of booze, are going to have those same problems. They're going to get the DUIs. They're going to end up in rehab. You know, it talks about this in the big book. You know, the heavy drinker looks much like the alcoholic. You know, well, you know, a transvestite looks much like a woman, but there's a big difference. You know what I'm saying? So there's a dash that our lives have become unmanageable. In the big book, it talks significantly about this, only it's spread out. I wish it was all like in one chapter, but it's not. It's spread out to, from the doctor's opinion to a vision for you. And what it talks about is being restless, irritable, and discontented, unless at, you can at once experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes from cracking a quart of vodka and putting a couple of gulps down. You know, how many of us in here have had that feeling of restlessness, irritable, and discontent? And we headed to the liquor store or the bar. And we're like, bartender, bartender, over here, over here. I got a serious problem over here. I'm sober. Here's $20. Line up three drinks. Don't let them empty out. You know, stay close. I mean, who says something like that except the alcoholic? Who's got a real problem with being sober? We do, because we're restless, irritable, and discontented on a normal basis in a sober state of mind. And the alcohol, what the alcohol does for us is this. And the tension and the fear and everything just falls off. That's unmanageability. What is the real problem? Booze isn't the problem. It's the spiritual malady. It's being uncomfortable with ourselves and our environment. That's the real problem. We're using booze as the solution. It's a bad solution, especially if you're alcoholic. Then it talks about the bedevilments, and it talks about anxiety. It talks about depression. It talks about self-centered fear, guilt, shame, remorse, all this emotional stuff. We're so attached with these negative emotions about our behavior that happened in the past or what's going to happen in the future or just the uncertainty we have about things being okay. You know, if you're new, you might think that that's just life on life's terms. You might not recognize that as acute alcoholism, but it is. It's the unmanageability of alcoholism. Now, do normal people, non-alcoholics, have a little depression and have a little anxiety? Sure. But it's not toxic, and they're not hanging on to it like a life preserver like we do. Then toward the end, when you get really chronically alcoholic, in the chronic stages, Bill talks about the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. That's what I would feel when I would start to go into the DTs, when I would start to detox from alcohol. Horrible, horrible. So many of us take our own lives because this is just so painful to go through. The emotional trauma is just too much to experience for any period of time. And we take our own life. The alcoholic is about 60 times more likely to take their own life than a non-alcoholic. How many people in here have known alcoholics who've killed themselves? I mean, over history is filled with this. And it's because of that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that we feel, you know, at the end of a spree. So this is the unmanageability. This is the spiritual malady. Brief descriptions of the spiritual malady. Each one of us is going to have a different palette with different colors of this unmanageability. And, you know, it'll be our own personal experience. But this is the alcoholism. That's what alcoholism is. So many people think alcoholism is drinking a lot. We drink a lot because of our alcoholism. I used to think that you were an alcoholic because you drank a lot. Now I think you drink a lot because you're an alcoholic. It's a different way of looking at it. Now, I'm going to meetings. This is like 1989, 1990. I'm going to a lot of meetings. I'm just plugging in. But what I don't realize at that period of time is is that the spiritual malady, the real alcoholism that's emotional, spiritual, psychic, mental, that real spiritual malady that is alcoholism, I didn't realize that it does not get treated by meetings. Meetings do not treat alcoholism. Neither really does service. What was designed to treat alcoholism was the 12-step process, which basically treats the spiritual condition. If I have guilt, shame, and remorse that I'm plagued by because of the all the ways I fell short in my past, if I make a list of the people and institutions that I've harmed and I go out and I make direct amends to those people, I'm not going to have that guilt, shame, and remorse anymore. You know, anxiety, depression, those are things that, unless they're clinical, with alcoholics, they're more situational problems, the depression and the anxiety. If they're truly alcoholic symptoms of alcoholism, the 12-step process has an answer for all of them when you actually take these steps. When you start to develop prayer and meditation techniques, you don't have the anxiety. You don't have the nervousness. You start to lose the fear, the self-centered fear. Each of these steps is an antidote to pieces of the spiritual malady. And that's what the treatment for alcoholism is. That's why we read how it works all the time. I used to hear all the time in the meetings somebody would share, like, I don't know how it works, but it just works. We just read how it works, you idiot. How it works is how it works, for God's sake. Anyway, I judge no one. You can be sure I had all kinds of patience and tolerance with everyone in the meetings early on. Oh, my God. I'd go, no, they're raising their hand. No, no, don't raise your hand. Don't. Oh, my God, they raised their hand. Don't call them. Don't call. Oh, no, they got called. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, God, no, I got to hear. That's what's going on in my mind, you know, while I'm in a discussion meeting, you know. Why don't you just drink and get the hell out of my meeting, you know. I'd be there. I'm grateful. Oh, how you doing today, Chris? Great. I'm going to slice your tires out in the parking lot later, but doing fine. Because I, you know, the first couple of years I was untreated. You know, no one had said, Chris, you actually have to do these steps to recover from alcoholism. It's not going to happen through osmosis sitting in closed-minded discussion meetings. Nobody told me that. They said, you know, just keep going to meetings. Keep coming. You know, you don't get it, it gets you, you know. Keep coming till the miracle happens, you know, is what I was hearing. Well, no miracle was happening with me. You know, I was no vision for you, I can tell you, in the first couple of years. Oh, my God. Along comes a buddy of mine, Radio Shack Mike. And Radio Shack Mike has some tapes. I mean, this is like 1990, you know, somebody that had like AA tapes. Like, what? How lame is that? Like, you know, come on, you know, you're gonna listen to meetings, you know, when you go home too. I mean, it was like really lame. But he had this set of 8 90-minute tapes, and it was a big book study, and it was done by the late great Joe and Charlie. And he said, look, you're hardcore. You'll probably like this. I didn't like it much. He hands it to me, and I start listening to it. Now, in a nutshell, here's what Joe and Charlie said. They said, there is a big difference between the fellowship and the program. If you raise your hand, you say, when I came into the program, you know nothing about what you're talking about. No one comes into the program. The program is the 12 steps as it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You come into the fellowship. Or you can come into AA, but you don't come into the program. That's like saying, I know nothing about recovery if you do that. Then they basically said, you know, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous are the instructions for the 12-step program. If you're working in AA program, then you are following the directions that are in the big book. Now, you got to understand that this pissed me off, okay? My first inclination was, here's what happens. You know, the alcoholic ego is you know, very fragile. And if somebody comes up to you and tells you you've been doing it wrong for 2 years, what's going to happen is you're going to say, no, I haven't, and you're going to try to figure out how to, you know, how to justify that you've been doing it right and those people are wrong. And that's really what happened with me. I started to say, well, where are these guys from anyway, these Joe and Charlie? They're from Arkansas, for God's sake. You know, they may do that in Arkansas, but in Jersey, we share, you know? You know what I mean? We share our weaknesses in New Jersey. And you know, I got really upset because I went through all these tapes, and I was like the critic going through there, like, you know, I'm seeing what's wrong with it. Because I like to be reinforced with what I already think is right. When new information comes in that goes against what I believe in, my ego throws up a wall, and it's very, very hard for new experience and new information to get in. But here's the problem. Is I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and this series of tapes explained the solution. There is a solution, and it is the 12 steps, and that's basically what these tapes were saying. Now, I really didn't want to hear this, but I was dying of untreated alcoholism, sober for well over a year, but still restless, irritable, discontented, still filled with guilt, shame, remorse, anxiety, depression, you know, just wrapped, you know. I remember even into my second year, I would have to like consciously unclench my fist because it would start to cramp up, because just in a normal state, I'd just be like clutching my fist, like, you know, with this tension. I was like a garage door spring, all that tension just waiting to like snap. And I the message in these tapes started to haunt me, and I started to realize that, you know what, all 400 people in all the meetings that I go to can be wrong, and these guys on this tape can be right, and I can have been doing it half measures, and I can have not been working a program for 2 years. And I started to come to that conclusion. And I remember a time where, you know, I was pushed up on with life happening at me in a big way. And I took these tapes out and I started listening to them. And I said, okay, I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to, you know, where there's an instruction in this book, I'm going to stop the tape. I'm going to do the instruction. If it says write out, I'm going to write. If it says go do this, I'm going to go do this. And then I'm going to go through this whole thing that way. And I'm basically gonna see what happens. And I did a really bad job of it. You know, I had no direction. There was no sponsors in my area that were bringing you over their house, taking you through the big book in, you know, 1990. You know, so I did the best I could with the tapes, the big book, and a notebook, and some willingness. And what happened was, I placed myself in the spiritual climate where God could start to heal my spirit. And my spirit started to heal. And the restlessness and the irritability and the discontent just started to leave me. I mean, it went from a scale 9, you know, down to like a scale 3 or 2. My depression, my anxiety, the shame that I had about the past, the self-centered fear I had about the future, you know, started to level down to a point where I was actually becoming comfortable with myself. I was actually becoming comfortable in social situations. I could actually share in public. I could ask the boss for a raise. I could ask a woman out on a date. That terrible sense of isolation and my attachment to what I was afraid you were thinking about me, you know, and the impression I was giving, you know, basically started to go away, and my spirit started to heal. And this was a really, really significant thing for me. By about this time, I was going to enough meetings and I was sharing enough that people were asking me to sponsor them. Now, I was sponsoring the way I was sponsored, which was, here's a quarter, give me a call, I'd like to see you at this meeting, you know, maybe go get a coffee commitment, let's go out to the diner. I mean, you know, it was interactive, but that type of sponsorship was about encouraging other people to not drink and go to meetings. It was encouragement. What the Joe and Charlie tape showed me was a program of recovery. Show me how to get freedom instead of relief. You know, instead of encouraging somebody to not drink, you can actually show them a way that they can be free. You know, read the 10-step promises sometimes. We can be free of this thing. We're never cured if we let up on our course of spiritual action. We will relapse if we're alcoholic, most likely. But we can be recovered and we can see some freedom. Now, these guys that I was sponsoring were drinking on me, which is just, it's inconvenient. You know, when you have all these guys and they're making you look bad in the meetings because people are coming up to you and asking you about, do you know that so-and-so smells like vodka? Yeah, I don't know. Really, really made me look bad. So I came up with this idea, and you know, I came up with it basically because it explains it in the chapter "Working with Others." Here's another forgotten chapter. I don't know where this had been, this book had been placed in the 80s and 90s, but it basically explains to us how we're supposed to work with other people in the chapter "Working with Others." What we're supposed to do as sponsors. We're not called sponsors because that term wasn't in place in 39, but it tells us how to be a good sponsor in the chapter "Working with Others." And I started to do that. I started to bring people over my house, and I started to take them through the big book. And I didn't know any better, so you know, when they went through the steps, I went through the steps with them. I thought, why? I can't ask somebody to do something if I'm not willing to do it myself. For some reason, I felt that way. So, you know, I went through the steps with a number of these people in the early 90s. And one of the things that is very significant from this experience is over the last 20 years or so, hundreds of people have asked me to work with them. The people that have gotten through the fourth and the fifth step, the people who have actually, which is a great word to put in front of the steps, actually made direct amends to other people, actually developed prayer and meditation disciplines, and actually started to work with other people, they're all still around. Every single one of these, it's 100%. Every single one of these guys are still around. They're card-carrying AA members in good standing, working with other people, showing up at meetings. The people that saw these steps as an overreaction to a problem that they couldn't really admit had them beat, they're all gone. They're gone from my life, at least. Sometimes I'll see some of them bounce in and out of meetings, but for the most part, they're not consistent with meetings. They're not home group members. They're not sponsors. They're gone. And there's different reasons for that. A lot of non-alcoholics show up in AA and do realize over a course of time that they really do have power and they really can change their lives by listening to an Anthony Robbins tape or something, and everything's good. People do get sent into us by mistake, believe it or not. But the alcoholics are almost sure to relapse, and many of them are dead. Many of them have had multiple relapse episodes. A lot of them now are on serious drugs like, you know, Suboxone and all this stuff, just zombied in their house, you know, on welfare or something. But most of them are just gone. And, you know, for me to see that if you do this, you're going to be okay, and if you don't do it, who knows? That's really a significant piece of information that that has changed my life. It's changed how I share. It's changed how I sponsor. It's certainly motivated a lot of the things that I do in my life today. I love alcoholics. Man, when back in the partying days, if you were about the business of getting the drinking done, I was with you. You know, I loved alcoholics, and I love them today. I love them better sober. You know, on the way down, we were listening to somebody who is friends with my wife, who was, you know, had a couple of bottles of wine and was a little bit shit faced, and you know, God bless her. You know, but I would rather hang out with somebody that doesn't repeat the same sentence three or four times and will actually remember tomorrow. You know, we're kind of the same. You know, we're the same people. We're exciting. We're not boring. You know, we have amazing capacities that, you know, we misuse, and we're just interesting people. And I love alcoholics, and I hate to see alcoholics die needlessly. Now, I want to end with this. I was dabbling around. Well, I actually still am. I'm on a couple of different boards in the professional addiction and alcoholism treatment realm. I know hundreds of people out there in the field who are very, very influential people in professional addiction and alcoholism treatment. And every once in a while, listen, I'm a big book guy, if that's not apparent already. I'm a big book guy, and I get defensive when professional treatment people criticize AA. Now, it's happening more and more. More and more we're getting criticized by the professional treatment people. Believe me, I'm in a place where I can see this. It's getting worse. This is a typical example. This guy, we're going back and forth on a LinkedIn group, you know, insulting each other. And this guy writes, and he basically says, look, I don't send anybody to AA anymore. AA has a 6% recovery rate. I can get better results with a placebo. Now, this is a psychiatrist saying this, okay? And I'm like, holy crap. You know, because that's true. The people who do statistics for AA meeting, you know, for AA statistics on, you know, recovery, what they'll do is they'll stand outside the door at any number of god-awful meetings, like in New York City or something, and they'll ask you, how long have you been in AA? And they'll take down all these statistics, and they'll find out that, yeah, you know, like 6% of these people are going to be here in a year, and 4 are going to be here in 5, and 2% are going to be here in 10 years. And all of that actually is true if you're taking your statistics at the door. But here's how I responded to this individual. I go, okay, you know, you're a doctor. You're in the medical trade. Let's say you treated people for cancer, and you had a specific procedure that you really believed in, and you had a hospital set up. And let's say 100 people came to that hospital because they were interested in that treatment. And 95% of them sat in the waiting room talking to other cancer sufferers about, oh, well, what happened with you today? And, you know, oh, geez, you know, my cancer's really, oh, my cancer's worse than yours. And only 5% of them actually go in to get the operation. Would you feel comfortable saying you only have a 5% recovery rate? Even though the 5 people that go in and get treatment recover, would it be fair to paint the picture that you have 5% recovery? And he goes, no. I go, well, you're doing that with us. Yes, it's true that 6% of the people walking in and out the doors will be here in 5 years. But what's also true is rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. I go, 95% of the people in AA don't thoroughly follow the path. They don't actually make amends. They don't have a prayer and meditation discipline. They don't take other people through the steps. They've held something back in their fifth step. you know, how can you blame us? We have a recovery process that works. You cannot pin us with a 6% recovery rate, or I'm pinning you for the people that sit in your waiting room. The meetings are the waiting room, is basically what I told this guy. And then he insulted me, and I quit the Facebook group because it wasn't going well. But I think I got my point across, you know. Listen, it's been a blast coming down here. This is a great group. I always like to support groups like this that unabashedly support solution and people that speak about recovery. And again, thanks, Ryan.